Welcome to the 21st episode of Atlantpodden. For our new listeners, Atlantfonden is a Swedish hedge fund management company where we have a global macro and fixed income focus. My name is Tanne Pikdoken. I'm one of the principal partners and portfolio managers of the firm. And today we have a very special episode because we have a very special guest. We're very delighted to be joined by one of our favorite macro commentators, Andreas Steno. He is the founder and CEO of the research firm that carries his name, Steno Research. He's also the host of our, probably my favorite podcast, which is Macro Sunday. So welcome, Andreas.
Thanks very much.
We have a lot to discuss today, but before we get into it, could you just give a short intro to yourself and to your research firm?
Yeah, sure. I'm basically born and raised in global macro. I started out in Nordea Bank as an FX strategist. So I'm born and raised professionally, at least in foreign exchange space, and then slowly but surely ventured into a cross-asset strategy role, ultimately concluding as the global chief strategist of Nordea Markets before deciding to start my own research company, also to be able to cover all asset classes with full independence, which is basically what I've always liked doing. So now we are roughly 12 months into the journey of this new research company, Steno Research. We have a great load of the largest macro hedge funds on earth as clients, and I really enjoy every second of it.
Yeah, great. Well, diving right into it, it's been a very volatile and interesting year, and I would say last 18 to 24 months, quite a big paradigm shift in rates and basically geopolitics and everything. So we have quite a wide range of topics to discuss. But if we sort of dive right into it, what is your general assessment of the current markets and investing environment? You know, we have rates at 5+%. You have equity valuations at quite steep levels. You have credit spreads, especially in the high yield segment, which are still quite compressed. So not really pricing in a lot of defaults yet. Do you think this is an environment to be aggressive or defensive in? So what's your general view?
I probably lean defensive, and we can elaborate on that story throughout the podcast today. I think the US Treasury market is in the driver's seat of right about everything right now, given that the moves that we've seen, particularly in the 10 to 30 year part of the yield curve in the US, has been sort of pinpointing moves across assets. It's also rhyming very well with everything that we've seen in commodity space since summer. And the main sort of underlying driver of all of this is a US budget deficit completely out of control. If you take some of the main categories of the US budget, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, they simply don't have control over the amount of dollars spent currently, and also with two wars to fund now, not only one anymore, it seems like the US budget deficit is sort of the main driver behind everything that we see across interest rates globally. And I think we've reached a point where real interest rates, so long-term interest rates adjusted for inflation expectations, are sufficiently high for cross-asset markets to care about them. Over time, I don't think it's feasible that we have so high real interest rates with current valuations seen both in credit space and equity space being kept intact at the same time. So either you hope for low interest rates next year, or else you need to be very defensive, I think.
Yeah, and I would say we generally agree with a lot of that. And there's a lot to unpack, but just, our general view has been that there is a lot of conflicting trends going on at the same time. So you have inflation in Europe, and we'll get into that a bit later in the podcast. But I mean, commodities tell one picture of the inflation side, with heavy underinvestments for a lot of years, and geopolitical turmoil obviously fueling the commodity prices. But at the same time, you have inflation in certain parts of the world, especially Europe, that are seemingly collapsing now and basically going into deflationary mode. So it's quite a tricky time to be a macro investor. So if we start with the commodity side, do you believe there's a potential super cycle there in the making, mainly fueled by many years of underinvestments into production, and add on top of that geopolitical turmoil now?
I think it's a fair long-term thesis. I'm not necessarily sure that I buy that thesis, say, over the next 6 to 12 months here. The supply side of the equation is very well known by now. If we look at global inventories across copper, nickel, zinc, energy products such as oil and natural gas, we find a relatively uniform picture across all of these commodities pointing towards inventories being low from historical standards. And I don't necessarily think it's a big surprise given everything we've seen out of the Chinese economy so far in 2023, especially when we talk about industrial metals, but also to a certain extent, natural gas. China is basically the marginal consumer of these commodities. For copper, we're probably talking 50, 55% of global demand. And when the Chinese real estate cycle comes to complete halt, as we've seen so far this year, no building activity, then obviously we need lower inventories than what we've grown accustomed to. So yes, I certainly subscribe to this underinvestment thesis, but we need the demand side to play ball to really buy into it.
Yeah, continuing on that, inflation is obviously a big theme for us and for basically every market participant now. And you know, we've seen, we're recording this on the 30th of October on a Monday, and we've had Eurozone inflation data points, you know, Spanish CPI and North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany, and PPI numbers last week that sort of indicate quite a big deflationary trend coming, which is obviously in sharp contrast to the US, where we still see inflation pressures being quite prevalent. Would you agree with that general assessment?
Yeah, I think it's a fair assessment. If we look at the details from just this morning from Germany, I think it's safe to say that at least parts of the consumer basket is in deflation now, especially when you look at the price of goods. So everything related to the manufacturing cycle and everything cyclical in the consumer basket is now declining in price. That's interesting, first of all. But the second thing I noted was that, especially when you look at Nordrhein-Westfalen, we have services printing at 0% month on month as well, after a decline in September as well. So, I mean, the broader labor market in Germany is also showing signs of weakness, because this is a cost category that is very clearly linked to wage pressures. So I think we have signs both of a cyclical downturn in Europe quite visibly now, but also signs of broader declines in the overall consumption appetite, which spills over to weaker wage pressures. So in general, I basically see this story unfolding right in front of us, and the European Central Bank has yet to really admit to it, but I think they will soon.
Yeah, and that's how would you contrast that to the US economy, which is, US consumers seem to be doing quite well, and the inflationary pressures are still not, you know, weakening to the degree that maybe we would have expected, with the rates, you know, rate increases being so dramatic in both in speed and size. So how would you contrast those two, you know, the Eurozone inflation with the US?
I think it's very much driven by the differences that we see in the underlying credit creation in the US economy relative to the European economy. First of all, the fiscal deficit in the US is basically out of league with anything that we see in the Eurozone right now. Even Italy is not able to sort of compete with the US fiscal deficit right now, at least in percentage terms of gross domestic product. So it basically means that the credit creation seen from the fiscal side is, at least outside of clear war times historically, one of the most pronounced credit cycles that we've ever seen in the US economy. And it also shows up in everything from the broad money supply to the availability of funding being better, I'd say, in the US, not good, but better than in the Eurozone. Also allowing for a larger investment pace, for example, in the manufacturing sector in the US. We've seen the amount of credit being made available to construction activity in the US at least triple this year. And if you look at it over the past, say, 24, 36 months, we've seen an increase of 800 to 1,000%. Everything is driven by the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, allowing for tax credits, subsidies for construction of factories within the battery industry, within the construction industry, and so on and so forth in the US. So I think it's very much driven by the industrial policy mix in the US, allowing for credit to float more freely around the US economy.
Yeah, and you know, as a ultimate sort of counterweight to that is the Swedish economy, and being a Swedish company, we have to mention that here the picture is dramatically different, because here most of the households obviously are in a mainly floating rate situation, where mortgages are, you know, close to 90% floating across the Swedish economy, which is, you know, extremely risky and very different from, you know, the global context, where here an interest rate increase, basically the three-month lag, hits the household economy right away. So here we have quite a different picture than the rest of the world, where we see quite clearly now that, you know, real estate prices have skyrocketed the last number of years, basically on a floating rate. Under a floating rate structure, and now these companies and the households are being hit dramatically, and inflation and consumption is obviously collapsing. So we are starting to see U.S. excellency here in terms of, you know, isolating consumers, at least for now, from the you know, brunt of interest rate hikes.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at the composition of corporate balance sheets in the US in the context of the moves that we've seen in interest rates, you have quite a few of the larger companies with very short duration assets in fixed income, but longer duration liabilities. So they're actually, so far, to a certain extent, net gainers of the interest rate hiking cycle, which is something that is a bit out of the normal or out of the ordinary. It typically takes, say, at the maximum 18 to 24 months for a hiking cycle to really make its way through the U.S. economy. But the lag is basically substantially longer this time, maybe even as long as 3 to 4 years.
Yeah. And if we look at the you know, global economy, are your recession models starting to flash red now, or still sort of amber-ish?
I think the only missing link in that recession puzzle is the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm really curiously awaiting the result of the so-called appropriations negotiations in the U.S. Congress. Because if we get just small signs or small steps towards fiscal consolidation in the U.S., and then I think a global recession is more or less a done deal. The global momentum is currently held up by the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and all of those very benign fiscal bills that were implemented over the course of the past year. Yeah,
and if we, you know, continue on the rates path here, it's been obviously a very brutal couple of weeks, months for bond bulls, you know, who basically been crushed. But are you starting to see that there's a time to add duration now, or is still, you know, obviously the supply picture in the US with deficits running at 8% of GDP, and looks like it's going to be around that level for the coming years, at least around 7 to 8%. So the supply picture is horrible. But are you starting to dive into duration, or is still too early?
So we actually bought a bit of euro duration last week on the back of the hopes that the softening trend seen in European inflation would lead the European Central Bank to change the rhetoric a little bit. They started doing that, but I still think they're a bit slow to react to this. So, I mean, it's not that we've had the best of starts to that bit, to be honest. And I'm still a bit skeptical around adding a lot of duration to portfolios right now, given that it is such a consensus view that duration will have to perform next year. It's like everyone agrees that the world cannot accept these levels of interest rates for long from here, meaning that the positioning across duration assets is very heavy. It is also, I think the main view of most investment banks that adding duration at 24 will be a great idea. It almost sounds like we're stuck on repeat from the sort of annual previews from the beginning of 2023, right?
Yeah.
Where everyone had that recession risk penciled into their forecasts. Everyone had the view that we cannot remain at these interest rate levels for long, et cetera. So it feels like an echo of the beginning of this year, which makes me very skeptical, because if everyone agrees on a narrative already, it should be at least partially reflected in the flows.
Yeah.
And that scares me, to be honest.
Yeah, and we I mean, obviously completely agree, because we've seen there is quite an interesting technical view here. And that is that if you look at TLT, which is an ultra long duration ETF, 20 year plus in the US, we've seen massive call option buying. So basically adding duration that way. But looking at treasuries, we've seen massive short positions. So there are, at least in parts of the global macro hedge fund space, it's been quite a big consensus view of rates going up and not down. And then we've obviously seen that the Bill Ackman short unwind, which, you know, at the face of it should have driven more duration adding. But and we saw that initially, I would suppose, but it got reversed quite quickly. So we are seeing quite big contrasting views. And I would agree that if we speak to in a number of banks, the consensus view is that you should definitely add duration, and especially US duration for 24. And we're still not seeing any big movements down in rates. So that is worrying.
Mm. And one thing I could add in terms of that positioning discussion in US duration is that if we look at futures data on a weekly basis, you're right that it looks like a big short position has been built up, say, over the course of the year in the US Treasury space. But I'm still not overly convinced that this is not just a result of basis trading from these hedge funds, so being short the future and long the underlying. At least it seems to me like it has to be part of the explanation. If you look at various softer surveys, such as JP Morgan's US Treasury survey, also conducted, I think, on a weekly or bi-weekly basis, the same hedge funds, the same set of funds say that they're actually net slightly long duration compared to their typical benchmark. So I'm confused from a positioning standpoint. And I'm not sure that the CFTC data is fully representative of the actual net short position.
Yeah. And, you know, continuing on with the fiscal side of it, and as we've spoken shortly about this, you know, the fiscal side and deficit side in the US looks atrocious from you know, numerous ways. And how long can the US continue to run such a loose and I don't want to say irresponsible, but you know, from a historical perspective, you know, being outside of a global world war, we are seeing deficits that are, you know, outside the normal framework and running at 8% of GDP, which is obviously massive. How long can this, you know, continue?
Well, I think the simple answer is for as long as they want to. They will just see the consequences in terms of how the markets react to it. I think it's clear that, especially over the past couple of months, we've seen a rise in term premiums, basically suggesting that markets want a larger premium to hold long-term US treasuries compared to just a few years back. And all of this happens amidst central banks not really supporting the bond market to any major extent, at least not from a flow perspective. They obviously do from a stock perspective still. So I think the ultimate reason why they will turn around on running such big deficits is that markets will tell them to do so. We saw the reaction to the so-called mini budget in the UK, was it in November 2022? So obviously, if we see, say, a move of 100 basis points, 150 basis points from here in the 10-year point, then I think the political willingness to turn around will certainly increase. But to me, it seems like we need that kind of lesson being taught.
Yeah, it feels like they will push it first. Yeah, it feels like they will push it to the brink.
Yeah.
And that has obviously gotten a lot of people to talk about a global broken financial system. And even, you know, the likes of Larry Fink and BlackRock are, you know, calling Bitcoin sort of a almost a flight to quality type of asset, which is you would never have thought that 5 years ago. So if we sort of skip the speculative part here around cryptos, but is there a discussion to be had regarding how the global financial system will look like in the future, and will cryptos or Bitcoin be sort of an answer to that following these last number of years with both monetary and fiscal policies being the way they've been? Do you see crypto being a broadly held institutional asset, mainly like gold used to be?
I certainly think that we will see increasing institutional activity in this space as a consequence of the lack of alternatives. And if we take a step back and link this discussion to the fiscal deficit of the US and the current monetary policy of the Federal Reserve, I made a large study on the balance sheet composition of the Federal Reserve and the ultimate links to the US Treasury. Because given that the Federal Reserve bought a truckload of US Treasuries at rates close to zero, they have a mark-to-market loss of trillions. They also have a running deficit of in between 100 and 150 billion from a cash flow perspective, because they pay interest on reserves held by the depository institutions in the US, banks, money market funds, etc., interest rates that are now higher than the holdings that they have in the QE basket. Is that an issue? Well, theoretically not, in practice not really, but it can turn into an issue because of the spillovers to fiscal policy. It basically means that as long as inflation is above 2%, the central bank cannot support the bond market. And the ultimate supporter of the economy then turns into fiscal policy, which is already stretched. So I think we will see further challenges to the current monetary system from a market perspective as a consequence of the Federal Reserve being cornered with negative cash flows amidst the situation of inflation above target, while the fiscal budget is already stretched when the central bank is calling for them to take action.
Yeah, and that is a very interesting point, because, you know, from what we've seen, you know, being a Swedish company, we are starting to receive more and more questions and comments from our own institutional clients, which are, you know, mainly the Nordic big insurance and pension companies. And, you know, 5 years ago, nobody would have asked us about cryptos, and that still seemed like a very, you know, very esoteric type of product. But now, you know, looking at some of these institutional portfolios, they are running something that is equivalent to a 60-40 portfolio. And the outlook here is starting to look, you know, there are scenarios where that portfolio will have a return that is, you know, a lot lower than what most of these investors need, which have, you know, basically forced them to look at other assets, because we've seen, you know, even looking at the last 4 to 5 weeks, you know, bonds going down dramatically and equity markets coming down a few percentage points. You are starting to see that there are, you know, periods in time where a 60-40 portfolio of an institutional level is not a good return provider. And if you need, you know, 5 to 7% of annual income, you are, you know, being forced to look at other asset classes. So even very conservative Swedish institutions are now starting to look at alternative assets.
And allow me to just briefly go down the crypto rabbit hole.
Yeah.
on the discussion of crypto being deflationary in nature relative to everything that we see in the old monetary system. By design, Bitcoin will the gains of mining Bitcoin will be halved by April 24 again.
Yeah.
So by design, that is a deflationary setup, if you ask me, because essentially you need the price of Bitcoin to continue up. Otherwise, the value of continuing to mine Bitcoins will simply drop over time, which is not a feasible medium term to long term scenario. Ultimately, that is also what will kill crypto over time, in my view, because you cannot use a deflationary currency, if you like, as the sort of mean of exchange between people, that will never turn into a feasible practical scenario. But from a portfolio perspective, as long as the trust remains intact in the crypto system, I actually think adding a deflationary currency to the portfolio makes a lot of sense while the world is inflationary. And I think that is why we see this odd move in Bitcoin right now amidst everything that's ongoing in the old monetary system.
Yeah. And just continuing on the 60-40 portfolio or composition mix, do you have any outlook for that kind of portfolio? Would you sort of, do you have a alternative in mind or something that you would suggest that people add instead? Because obviously a lot of the really big pools of capital, especially in the Nordics, are tied to a 60-40 or 50-50 type of portfolio with a very big focus on duration, which, you know, under a zero interest rate regime has been horrible, but still hasn't been fantastic these last couple of months either, because you have no income and then now you're starting to see quite big mark-to-market losses on the portfolio. What's your outlook there?
So if you study it over long time periods, the 60-40 portfolio, sort of the deal breaker for that portfolio is if inflation runs roughly above 3.5 to 4%. Below 3.5 to 4%, the good old diversification effects typically kick in. So I'm a bit less downbeat on the prospects of the 60-40 portfolio in European terms relative to US terms, also given the discussion we had on inflation. But I'm also of the view that this is not the last inflation wave that we've seen, say over the next 5 to 10 years, meaning that this 60-40 portfolio will be challenged on an ongoing basis. So how do you actually add something to the mix here that replaces the diversification effects of fixed income in times of turbulence and exactly when you need it? The only good alternative that I've been able to find so far is energy stocks. They have a tremendous capability of performing when everything else in the portfolio does not perform. We've seen it from, say, August 1st and onwards, again this year, with pretty decent gains in oil and natural gas companies relative to the turbulence that we've seen in duration assets, both in equity space and in fixed income space. So I've labeled energy stocks the new fixed income of 60-40 portfolios. Obviously, that is solely based on portfolio reflections. I see loads of reasons not to implement this view, from everything from ESG standards to considerations around the future energy policy mix and all that. But if you look at it solely from a numbers perspective, that's my best suggestion on how to handle this situation.
Yeah, and a big part of that is something that's been, you know, out of fashion the last couple of years, but that was cash flow. These companies produce such a massive amount of cash flow, which obviously is something that all the portfolios in the world should welcome, but it's not been the, I'm not going to say flavor of the month, it hasn't been in fashion for a number of years, because, you know, cash flow was money you could reinvest to grow. So why would you pay that out? Yeah. But I completely agree that just on those merits, obviously all the big institutional portfolios should have a small allocation to something that is very cash flow generative.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a good example of a sector with a strong cash flow generation relative to the wage cost base. And that's one of my main takeaways ahead of 2024, that if you look at wage pressures, they will likely abate in a much slower fashion than sort of broader price pressures. That's typically what we see both on the way up and on the way down for inflation, that wages tend to lag the overall price developments by, say, 2, 3, 4 quarters, depending on where you look in the world. Basically meaning that wage inflation could remain at 4-5% throughout 2024 as a lagged consequence of everything that we've seen this year and last year. And in such a scenario, you want a company that generates a lot of cash flow without having to pay high wages. It sounds simple, but the oil and natural gas industry is a great cast for that, while companies with, say, 60 to 80% of the cost base being wages, they will struggle in such a scenario with selling prices under pressure while they have a firm wage pressure on the cost side.
Yeah. Continuing downwards the sort of the rates path and talking about credit, you know, credit spreads are, at least in our view, still quite tight, especially if you would consider a slowing economy with some increase in defaults and delinquencies going forward. So especially, you know, considering that you do have quite a big wave of refinancings coming globally, 2024, 2025, and, you know, the beginning of 2026. And it's, I would say, a fair assumption that a lot of these companies will need to refinance at much higher rates. You know, for some, that will come with you know, effects of them needing to clean up the balance sheet. But do you have any outlook for investment grade and high yield returns here going, you know, let's look 12 to 18 months into the future?
So I think, once again, there's a bit of a divergence between the outlook in Europe and in the US. I produced a very telling chart on the CCC and lower spreads relative to swaps in the US versus Europe. And it seems like, especially for that segment of the market, so as close to junk as you get, basically, you find a cycle that is much more connected to reality in Europe than it is in the US. So that is clearly one of the bets that I'm considering right now, whether to short the high yield space in the US in anticipation of the US sort of following the path of Europe, just with the time lag, because of those longer time lags on interest rates. It basically also means that I'm probably a tad more upbeat in investment grade space than I am in high yield space, and I don't think that's out of the ordinary if we stare directly into a recessionary scenario for the first half of 24. But in my view, Europe is closer to reflecting reality than dollar markets when it comes to credit, especially when we move out the risk curve towards non-investment grade high yielders.
Yeah, and you know, again, as a Swede, looking at the U.S. investment grade market, we're sort of salivating because you are able to construct a portfolio of very high quality companies, you know, yielding 6 to 7%, and you're able to get that on basically with very negligible risk. You're able to tie that in or basically lock it up for the coming 2 to 4 year period, which is, at least to us, extremely attractive, looking into quite an uncertain geopolitical situation, slowing economy and so on. So we're still not there in our core markets. But I would assume that, I mean, if I was a US-based investor, what is sort of the case for, you know, being overweight equities at this point when you are able to buy treasuries or T-bills basically at 5%+, and then you're able to add on top of that some credit risk in the higher parts of the investment grade market and add, you know, 100 to 200 basis points on top of that, and basically have a mixed portfolio yielding somewhere, you know, 6 to 7%. Why would you be invested in S&P here if you had the option of, you know, being switching over from between asset classes?
I mean, if you look at it from, say, a pure duration matched yield perspective, then you basically have no arguments unless you're extremely upbeat on the prospects of Nvidia, Amazon, etc., beating earnings expectations by miles. That is essentially what's needed to be an equity bull here and now. Obviously, if you look at earnings yields in the S&P, they're heavily influenced by the Big Seven, and if you set those aside, you're still running at, say, between friends, 2 to a couple of percent probably in earnings yields on top of the risk-free T-bill. But still, with that said, 2% risk premium, it's not particularly compelling from a historical perspective, especially not when you compare it to the credit space. So I share your sentiment. Unless you have an extremely bullish view on artificial intelligence driving results from Nvidia and similar types of companies to the moon over the next 12 to 24 months, then everything both theoretically and practically tells you not to be aggressive in your equity allocation.
Yeah, and that, you know, very well may be. It's just that, you know, short or let's say solid investment grade companies seems like such a fantastic place to hide. in quite uncertain times. And if we continue on the equities path here, by the time of recording, the S&P is up around 8% a year, and Nasdaq is up around 20%. So it's been, you know, looking at what's happening in the world, still been quite a decent year, especially in the US, not as much in the Eurozone. But do you have any short-term outlook, let's say 6 to 12 months, looking at global equities here against the backdrop of current rate levels, weakening economy and geopolitical risk, so on? It doesn't sound like you're the biggest bull in the market here.
No. I mean, if you look just beneath the surface of those moves in the US market, you have the information technology index up by 33% in the S&P.
Yeah.
You have consumer discretionary up 20%, right? So it's very Tesla driven, it's very Nvidia driven, all of these index moves. Beneath the hood, you have negative returns across basically everything else. So I think the defensive positioning is very warranted. I also struggle to see how these big seven will be able to pull the market up. Should I be right that the discretionary spending is on its way down? I think it's very telling that you currently only find positive volume developments in forward-looking gauges of orders to inventories in sectors such as chemicals and the auto sector. And those two sectors are basically, they've basically both seen declining prices over the course of this autumn. And I think it's very telling that you need to lower your selling prices to have a decent outlook from a volume perspective relative to current levels. And therefore, I also consider that very telling for the broader equity trends. I struggle to see that you're paid sufficiently to take equity risk here relative to both what you suggested in investment grade space, but even versus the T-bill, it just seems like a relatively bad bet.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, this podcast wouldn't be complete. You are Danish, so you are close to us here in Sweden. But it's always interesting to hear your sort of outside-in view of Sweden. And just to set the backdrop, we just had last week that the Swedish Riksbank is asking the government for an 80 billion Swedish krona capital injection to basically account for their negative equity after all these years of QE and rate manipulation. And that's, you know, I think, yeah, on the looks of it is quite sensible that they need to balance their books basically. But you have that, and then you have real estate, of course, that is, you know, still very squeezed, massive maturity wall in both within the banking sector, but also in the capital markets here, with huge bond issuance the last couple of years, needing to refinance at rates that are 2 to 5 times what they were 2.5 years ago. So obviously, very curious to hear your view about the Swedish economy and the Swedish krona, which obviously has been completely massacred the last couple of years here.
Yeah, so I noticed Governor Tidian asking for that capital raise, and it actually led me to make this study on global central banks and the negative equity. I don't necessarily think it's a big issue that the Riksbank has a negative equity. The way they solve it in Germany is that they just allow for future earnings to make up the negative equity in the Bundesbank. In the US, they just treat the negative equity as a deferred tax asset. So ultimately, the US Treasury could recapitalize them, but they can run with negative equity for basically as long as they want, at least under the constraint that inflation is not a problem. They've had the same discussion in Australia with Michelle Bullock taking over the role as governor in the Reserve Bank of Australia after a discussion on how to recapitalize the Reserve Bank of Australia as well. But ultimately, I think this is very telling for the outlook for the Swedish economy, because when the Riksbank asks for fiscal aid, they try to do that ahead of the actual turmoil that could be around the corner in the European economy, because they don't want to ask for capital amidst the perfect storm in funding markets, for example. So I think it's a bit telling that Governor Tidian is asking at this juncture. But having said that, the Swedish economy is probably currently the weakest performing if you look across all of the peers that we track in the northern part of Europe. And that's, to me, typically a harbinger that this will probably spread to Germany, Denmark, etc., with a short time lag, because the Swedish economy is probably, alongside Canada and Australia, basically one of the most and highest interest rate sensitive economies in the world. And I'm, while we're talking here, I'm trying to look up a chart on the Economic Tendency Survey from Sweden, the NIER Institute, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And if you look at the expectations for the orders book in that survey relative to the current message from the average CEO in listed Swedish companies, there's a pretty decent gap in a negative sense, meaning that the flow expected on the order side is weaker than what is being told or rather communicated through the reporting season here. So also from an equity standpoint, I think there are lagged effects that we should expect into first quarter and second quarter next year from a negative flow perspective in terms of orders in Sweden. And then obviously I think a lot of global participants, they watch the commercial real estate market in Sweden with a high degree of curiosity, since they know if interest rates remain high for longer, as most central banks try to tell us they will, then these issues seen in Sweden over the past year or two, they will slowly but surely show up elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's such a bizarre situation here, because I mean the by the time of my last personally speaking, by the time of my last mortgage fixing, my mortgage was 0.84 per annum, and now when it's time to refinance the fixed part of that, it's I'm being offered 4.65, and that's sort of the that's spread across the entire economy, with basically almost 100% of the Swedish households being on floating rate notes. So obviously you're meeting interest rate payments that are five times or more what you used to have, 2 years ago. So a big part of the households tend to have 2 year fixed for a big part of the mortgage, and then it comes due today or this year. So obviously consumers will, and they're already starting to feel it, but that will only increase. And obviously the part of the economy having 1 million US equivalent in SEK terms of mortgages have increased dramatically the last couple of years. So just dividing mortgage numbers by disposable income, you are basically around the highest in the world. And on top of that, you put the nasty point of having almost all of that on a floating rate structure. So obviously the consumer in Sweden will start to be squeezed by rising unemployment, rising mortgage rates, and falling real estate prices. So it's really hard to be bullish on the Swedish economy here going forward, 12 to 18 months, unfortunately.
Yeah, I would agree. And the final point I can add to that is, I mean, if you compare inflation trends across Europe, even amidst all of this, the Swedish inflation trend actually seems slightly worse than what we see elsewhere. I mean, the Danish CPI is printing at 0.8, I think, while the Swedish was at 6.5 thereabout in the last update. So quite the difference.
Yeah. So we always like to end on a, normally we always like to end on a solid point, but I think this is worthwhile, passing on to the big part of our listener base, which is based here in Sweden, that, there is a point to be, there is a time and place to be aggressive and a time and place to be defensive. And I think both of us tilt towards the more defensive side here.
Yeah. And my best guess is that sometime during the second quarter of 2024, the tide will turn dramatically in terms of the Swedish performance relative to the rest of the world, in the direction that Sweden will no longer be seen as the problem child or the biggest risk from an interest rate perspective relative to other economies suffering with a larger time lag. So I actually think that the Swedish krona could turn into a massive positive trade, but it's not yet.
yeah, fingers crossed that that time comes sooner rather than later. And just, you know, to wrap up and conclude here, so it seems at least that we both are of the view that this is a point to sort of look over the portfolio and try to, not a bit too early to add duration, I suppose, is what I gathered from your points on rates. And energy stocks is, you know, that is a very interesting point because that is a very small, maybe even a non-existent part of most Nordic institutional portfolios here. That is not a big part of what people have. And so massive underweight towards those. And maybe that is a very solid point for our listeners to take into account and see if there are parts of the 60/40 portfolio that you can exchange for the yeah. Energy stocks. Anything else you want to pass on, Andreas, as concluding remarks?
So I actually think a lot of what we're seeing right now rhymes very well with market developments that we've seen 3 to 6 months ahead of actual recessions. Energy has performed pretty okay over the past 3-4 months compared to the rest of the market. We see increasing oil and natural gas prices on a trend basis right now. Typical stuff that you see ahead of the recession, while duration is something that you add when you're certain that the central bank has hiked for the last time. I'm relatively certain that the European Central Bank has hiked for the last time. I'm not certain that the Fed has hiked for the last time. So therefore, there's a big discrepancy in my view on duration in the Eurozone versus the US. And then in surrounding countries around the Eurozone, I still wouldn't rule out that we have a hike ahead of us, but we're approaching the time where duration gets more interesting, but for now only in euro terms to me.
Yeah, just on a point on the Eurozone duration, just something that was on my mind, you sort of basically alluded to it earlier, but do you still, do you dare to go into Italian duration or still, you know, hiding in the more solid parts of the Eurozone?
So to be precise, I've entered the iShares 20-year target duration fund,
yeah,
which does not include peripheral bonds. So we're talking core and semi-call. So you're getting a bit of Austrian exposure, the Netherlands, Finland, etc., but nothing in Southern Europe. And I still think that's the main takeaway from the European Central Bank not willing to sort of commit to a turnaround of their balance sheet policy. They're even discussing still, it seems, that they could decide on not fully reinvesting the pandemic purchase program on top of the good old APP QE program that they started way ahead of the pandemic. If they decide not to really reinvest the full notional of the PPP, the pandemic program, then we need wider premiums in Italian bonds relative to German and French bonds.
Yeah. Well, Andreas, it's been a great honor to have you on our podcast. A lot of food for thought, and I'm sure, you know, we'll have plenty of discussions going forward. Thank you for all the information, and you're obviously someone we've followed for a long time, so really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
Thank you, Andreas. Take care.